Hey, super. Thank you very much for recording. I was told I was supposed to, but I see I can't, so I'm glad you are. Just so somebody records, that's all that really matters. We are here for the guiding light, What is Self? And I am opening up to page 16. And I'm going to begin today with the first paragraph on page 16 that starts with, we cannot come upon mature existence. That's where I'm beginning. So here we go. We cannot come upon mature existence or right living until we first come to the egoless unitive condition. And we read this sentence last week. I remember discussing it. I think we just didn't finish the paragraph. We cannot come upon mature existence or right living until we first come to the egoless unitive condition. Only the true unitive self is able to live fully and fearlessly in the world. It is only after the true self has been lived to the fullest extent of its potential that it ultimately falls away. Self or consciousness falls away because its purpose and potential for full human existence has been completed or finished. So that's interesting. So, in A Course in Miracles, it talks about how God takes the last step. And so what she is saying here is that God takes this last step to full awakening when we have done two things. One, in whatever way that it happens, I think she'll talk about that later, in whatever way that happens, first of all, we've awakened from the ego to the unitive state. That's the first thing that she says has to happen. And then the second thing that has to happen is we have to live the fullest extent of the potential of the unitive state. And once we've lived that fullest extent of the potential of the unitive state, then the full potential for human existence has been completed. And that's when consciousness falls away. Now, I can't say I know 100% for that to be true. You know, lots of times when people talk about awakening, they talk from their own experience because their own experience is all that they know. But I also can't say that that's not true. So it's just kind of interesting to contemplate that these two stages may be first the efforting that is a part of letting go of the ego, and then living fully from that unitive state until it's been maxed out, right? And then it falls away. So it's kind of an interesting perspective. Whether that's true or whether that was just her experience, I can't say for sure. The next thing I'm going to turn to is on page 17. It's called the ego, and she's going to talk here about then that first movement, which is the movement of letting go of the ego so that we can awaken to the unitive state. Now, she defines the ego a little differently, I think, than the way I've always defined it. So we'll start by looking at that. She says the term ego articulates a specific experience. Its best articulation might be this. The ego is what we feel when self-will is crossed, blocked, or otherwise thwarted. I'll read that again. The ego is what we feel when self-will is crossed, blocked, or otherwise thwarted. So what she is saying here is there's a desire for self-will. And as long as I'm getting what I want, She's not describing that feeling as ego. She's describing ego as the feeling that arises when I don't get what I want. And that's a different definition than I've always used, or even a different definition that I was taught from within. For example, if you really pay close attention to NTI, you will notice that NTI would define ego as self-will. So it wouldn't really matter whether that self-will was being thwarted or whether I was getting what I wanted. You know, maybe my experience of the ego would be different, right? I might not notice the ego when things are going my way. We might notice the ego more when my self-will is thwarted, when I'm not getting what I want. But I have never defined the ego as only the negative side of that coin. I would define the ego as the full coin. I would define the ego as self-will. I've also defined the ego as just the sense of self, the sense of a me, right? Some people would call that the sense of separation, right? There's a me and a not me, right? So that's the ego. So I would probably define the ego as those two things, self-will and the sense of a definite, distinct me, separate from other things. But again, her definition of the ego, because everyone's allowed to define words the way they choose to. So there's not a right or wrong here. I just wanted to clarify there is a difference in the way that we're using the word. She says that the ego is what we feel when self-will is crossed, blocked, or otherwise thwarted. It is the psychological pain that underlies all tantrum behaviors, anger, hitting back, revenge, anxiety, and much more. It is the cause of true psychological and spiritual suffering, and always symptomatic of an imbalanced, immature psyche. And again, I would agree with her and disagree with her here. I would agree with her that the suffering itself is symptomatic of an imbalanced, immature psyche. You know, if we look at the Bhagavad Gita, talks about what they call the three gunas, right? There's tamasic, which is kind of the lowest energy guna. The tamasic person is the one who might be addicted to drugs or alcohol, might have commitment trouble with jobs or relationships, might be lazy, lethargic, not necessarily all of these things, maybe all of these things, but, you know, maybe one or another, you know, so it's kind of the lower energy. You know, I would say that our jails, our prisons are filled with people of the tamasic level of vibration, right? And then the next level of vibration is rajasic, or Americans often say rajasic. And that's what we consider more of our successful people. That's setting goals and going out and attaining things. You know, Jasmine's rajasic, right? She's going to college. She's getting a double engineering major. That's very rajasic activity. And then the highest energy level is the sattvic. And the sattvic is the one who really is living in alignment with our true heart. So this person may be humble, generous, you know, contemplates before speaking or acting, maybe is really tuned within. But one thing that the Bhagavad Gita really emphasizes is that all three of these energies are still non-awakened energies. They're still egoic. Right? At least maybe the suffering is gone, but the sense of me is still present. And until the suffering, the self-will, and the sense of me are all gone, there's not yet an awakening. So, you know, we see We see a lot of suffering at the tamasic level. We see a lot of self-will. Self-will is very prominent in the rahasic level, but the sense of me is still very, very present at the sattvic level. And so what she is saying is that the ego is the true psychological and spiritual suffering and always symptomatic of an imbalanced, immature psyche. Well, I would agree that especially at tamasic level is very imbalanced and immature. The rahasic level seems more mature in a worldly way, but could be just as immature spiritually. And then the sattvic level is where you have a mature, balanced psyche, but again, still a sense of me, right? So she defines the ego just a little differently, is all that I'm pointing out. I'm not trying to say there's a right or a wrong here, because ego is a word and it can be defined in more than one way. I just want to be very clear, since you all listen to my teachings a lot, I want to be very clear about when she's speaking about ego, what she's saying, and when I'm speaking about ego, what I'm saying. And we're not saying the same thing, right? So she says that the ego is the psychological and spiritual suffering, and that it's always symptomatic of an imbalanced, immature psyche. She says the ego is the interior movement we experience when we do not get what we want. See how she's defining it very narrowly there. The ego is the interior movement we experience when we do not get what we want. It is also the experience of near, It is also the experience of near uncontainable highs when we do get what we want. So there she goes. Now she's expressing the other side of that. So if I don't get what I want, right, then there may be anger or frustration or disappointment or whatever. She calls that ego. But if I do get what I want and I'm very happy because I'm getting what I want, she is now adding that to ego. And that's what I would have also called ego. So now we're aligned, which is great. So again, I would say that self-will itself and the sense of me are what create the ego. She says the ego, and here we go, this is also a little different maybe. She says the ego is first and foremost the feeling self. It is not, primarily at least, the knowing self. Merely to know something exists, an object, a virtue, something good or bad, does not mean that we want it for ourselves. The ego springs alive only when we want something for ourselves and are determined to get it, possess it. Now, this sentence is a little interesting. If you happen to be in Gentle Healing Year 3, I gave a special assignment on Tuesday night of last week, which is to pay attention to the thinking, pay attention to when the mind is spinning, and look to see if there's a want, some type of a want in there. And I pointed out that wanting to avoid something is also a want, right? And I've had a couple people give me feedback already, and what they're finding is, yes, when the mind is really, really spinning and they look, they can find a wanting going on in there. Well, here she says that the ego springs alive only when we want something, right? So it's kind of an interesting coincidence that we would come across this right after that assignment. But that seems to be what people are finding, as far as if we call springs alive, if we talk about the spinning, like the ego is really chattering, da 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 da, right? What really seems to lead to that chattering is wanting something, and there may be another thing too, which probably still has a wanting underneath it, if we really look deeply. But at a surface level, it might appear differently, and that's fear. If we fear something, right? If we fear something, the ego also can become very, very active. So wanting something, that concludes wanting to avoid something. Maybe fear and wanting to avoid something are the same thing, right? really causes the ego to get very, very active. So the ego springs alive only when we want something for ourselves and are determined to get it, possess it. And again, I would include in this or avoid it, right? We want to avoid. This affirms that the ego is experience of self-will. So here we go. Now she is defining the ego the same way I do. She just started off a little differently in her discussion. This affirms that the ego is the experience of self-will, a will turned solely on itself that seeks its own fulfillment and benefit. That's the kind of sentence that we just need to be quiet for a second and really look at that. I mean, you know, you've heard me talk so many times about the ego can't help but be selfish. You know, when we are thinking in alignment with the ego, we are thinking how we can get things the way we want them to be. That's just the way the ego thinks. You can do that on a national level. That's what politics is all about. I mean, really, that's what politics is all about. You know, politics is nothing but different groups of people, you know, primarily two in our country, but there are different groups of people wanting the world to go my way. And this is why I don't find right and wrong in politics. A lot of people do. Most people, I think, do. They'll point to one side or the other, you know, that side is wrong. But there isn't a right or wrong in politics. There's just self-will in politics. And the one that you think is right is the one that's closest to your personal self-will. You see? It's just different self-wills. There's nothing right or wrong in it. So the ego is the experience of self-will. A will turned solely on itself that seeks its own fulfillment and benefit. You know, I can read further, but something in me is just saying, stay with this. You know, let's just stay with this. Let's just notice. I mean, we've all got it. Let's just notice that part of me. It wants everything to work out the way I want it to work out is the ego. And yet again, how much attention do we give to that? It's laughable. How much attention do we give to that? So how much attention do we give to the ego? Those of us who say we're here to let go of the ego, think about it. I can see Francine thinking about it. Think about it. Every time you're trying to get things to be the way you want them to be, you're actually clinging to the ego instead of letting it go. Oh my God. It's a lot of clinging, isn't it? The ego is the experience of self-will, a will turned solely on itself that seeks its own fulfillment and benefit. When frustrated, this egoic power or energy has given rise to all the evils in the world. Yet the same ego, well, let me stop there before we read the rest of this sentence. When frustrated, this egoic power or energy has given rise to all the evils in the world. So we're not just talking about war here. You know, we're talking about parents beating their children, spouses beating spouses, people stealing from one another, people, quote, betraying one another. You know, just everything that you can think of that people do to one another in a negative way is because of this experience of self-will, a will turned solely on itself. Like there was the story, I can't remember, I know I shared it, but I can't remember where I shared it. There was the story recently, oh, I think it was in a retreat, so you guys probably didn't hear it. There was a story recently about a woman, she was in China, and she beat her daughter to death with a metal rod because her daughter was eating too slowly. You see how that is a will turned solely on itself. I want you to eat faster. And I want it so much that when I tell you to, and I tell you to, and I tell you to, and you don't, I'm going to grab this metal rod and I'm going to beat you, and beat you. And in this case, until this little, I remember she was 5, 6, or 7, but this little girl was killed. And I was listening to Kate this morning. Of course, Kate didn't grab a metal rod and beat her grandson. But Kate was talking about the same frustration. I think she was saying he kept taking his shoes off. And she wanted him to put his shoes on, right? And she was talking about the rage. Now, she didn't act on it. Or at least she didn't act on it in that way. She may have said something to him. But she didn't act on it in the way that this Chinese woman did. But that rage of not getting what I want. I want you to quit taking your shoes off, right? We all know this, don't we? Is this new to anybody, right? That's a will turned solely on itself. So when frustrated, this egoic power or energy has given rise to all the evils in the world, and we've all got it. There isn't one of us here that doesn't. And we all feed it by trying to get things to be the way that we want them to be. You know, one spiritual practice that's arising in my mind that could be practiced if we want to start reversing this is start doing things somebody else's way. Right? You know, I mean, we all have maybe spouses or family members or friends, somebody that we can submit to. Sometimes when I use that word, somebody has a reaction. But you know, I've always thought that the women in the Bible had a bigger advantage than the men. You know, usually people look at the Bible when the Bible says women submit to your husbands, and they think, oh, women shouldn't have to submit to their husbands. But actually, spiritually, I've always thought the women had the advantage. Who knows, maybe that's why today when you go to a spiritual group, there's more women around than men, because, you know, the women, just that psyche has had the advantage of submitting, right? I mean, think about that. Submit to your family members. Unless, of course, guided not to. I mean, there could be a situation where you're genuinely guided not to. But what if you made it a spiritual practice, you know, as long as nothing is being harmed, of doing things their way? And in this case, I would say husbands submit to your wives. And in fact, I think Ron, not too long ago, told a story in the sanctuary about how he was planning to come here for the hiking retreat in September, and he was planning to come here for both retreats, for the fall retreat. And his wife has recently started a new business, and she asked him to stay home just in case something goes wrong, just in case she needs his help. And he felt the guidance to submit to his wife. You see how that's letting go of ego? And in fact, there are stories in the Bible about when God told men to submit to their wives, even though that wasn't what Paul taught in the New Testament. There are stories in the Bible of God doing that. You know, there's the story of Abraham and Sarah. Sarah wanted to have a child, and she was barren. She couldn't. And so what she did, which was a tradition back then, was she gave her slave girl, Hagar, to sleep with her husband, Abram, and who later became Abraham. And of course, Hagar became pregnant. And then when Hagar gave birth, Hagar sat on Sarah's lap as she gave birth, which was an adoption act, which meant the child was really Sarah's. However, since Hagar is the one that nursed the child actually had a bond with Hagar. And then later, through a miracle of God, Sarah became pregnant. And she gave birth to her own child. And once she gave birth to her own child, she now saw Hagar, and Hagar's child is kind of in the way. And the husband loved both children and actually loved both women. And so she wanted Abram to kick Hagar and her child, Ishmael, out of the tribe. Now, of course, this is a very harsh decision, because the only way they know how to survive is with the tribe. To be kicked out into the desert and without a tribe, a woman and a boy, you know, it's very harsh. And Abraham did not want to do this. I mean, after all, Ishmael was his son too. And in fact, it was Sarah's idea that he have a child with Hagar, right? But when he went to God and he asked God what he was to do, God told him to submit to his wife and not to worry. He said, God said, I will take care of Hagar and Ishmael, right? But it's a great example of let go of your self-will. Let go of how you want things to be, right? So one thing we can do is start looking for opportunities to surrender to those around us. Now, I will tell you, that could also be something that we have to be careful about, because let's say Shauna and Jay and Cheryl and Jacqueline and I, you know, and Francine, those of us who live here, we all decide we want to surrender to the others. And then we say, okay, where do you want to go eat? And everybody's, no, you decide. You know, it goes nowhere. So sometimes submitting to others is making the decision about where we're going to go eat, right? So you have to kind of pay attention to withinness around that. But I'm sure you will find lots of opportunities to lay down your self-will and surrender to those spouses, those family members, those friends, those coworkers, instead of insisting so much or trying to figure out so much how everything can be your way. See if there's anything else I want to read in one more minute. Maybe I'll just reread this. The ego springs alive only when we want something for ourselves and are determined to get it, possess it. This affirms that the ego is the experience of self-will, a will turned solely on itself that seeks its own fulfillment and benefit. When frustrated, this egoic power or energy has given rise to all the evils in the world. Yet the same ego, oh, that's the part I hadn't gotten to, and I don't want to, because that's going to start a new topic and I'm out of time, so I'll get to that next week. So this week, contemplate not feeding that self-will so much, right? And releasing the mic.